The man dies having made very little apparent progress in his merit. Life three. A man... never mind. A man inherits a lot of money at a young age and continues to work hard in the world and brings up a family. Who has spent their time in the most worthwhile way? Those of you who know me know the answer. By renouncing the... it's always by far the most worthwhile way. Even if you think you haven't made much progress, it's like the man has worked all his life within the Sangha, and the sort of paycheck he gets in his next life is huge. It's just renouncing. Just that much is worth so much more than thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, billions of dollars given to charity. This is why the Buddha actually talked about in the Mahakamma Vibhanga Sutta about the different levels of good karma. If someone gives $1 billion to my monastery and someone else takes the three refuges, the one who takes the three refuges makes them more merit. The one who takes the three refuges and one who keeps the five precepts. The one who keeps the five precepts makes heaps more merit. For those who keep the five precepts and one who gets the liberation of the mind through metta, this is metta jhana, the one who gets that jhana, heaps more merit than keeping the five precepts all your lifetime. When you understand this, about what merit is, what karma is, good karma is. Good karma is getting close to nibbana. This is why it's like living the life of a Buddhist monk. Even if you don't seem to think you're getting anywhere, just if you keep those precepts and keep them reasonably well, and are sort of devoted to those precepts, if keeping five precepts is much, much, much more merit than giving billions of dollars to monasteries or charity. Keeping 227 precepts is huge. Or being a nun, huge merit. But being a Buddhist monk or being a Buddhist nun, if you don't keep those precepts, then that's huge demerit. It's true. This is what it said in one of the commentaries, and it's a very good sermon. It's like a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun is like on top of an elephant. If they stay on, they're having a good time, but if they fall off, they've got much further to fall. So you've got to be very careful there as a monk or a nun. If you're going to be a monk or a nun, keep those precepts. If for some reason you can't keep those precepts, then disrobe before you break them. And this is actually how that you're building up renunciation, you're building up the purity of the mind, and if that's all you do, then at the end of your life you've done a lot of purification of sila, of the morality and precepts. And that by itself will be worth so much. Your meditation will probably come later on, maybe in the next life, or the lives afterwards, but if you keep your sila there, you're making huge foundations for the practice of meditation and for the practice of wisdom. People in the world don't realize that keeping precepts frees you. Very often I talk about freedom, and so often that the world, what they call is freedom, I call that being in prison. What they call freedom is being in the prison of your defilements, your kilesas. Being in the prison of anger, being in the prison of greed and lust, desire. But when you actually keep precepts, even like five precepts, you feel so much freedom. Freedom from many worries, freedom from many desires. Instead of being pushed around by ill will, by anger, by lust, by desire, by greed, you're free. You're keeping precepts, you don't have to eat anything, you don't have to watch the telly, you don't have to do all these things. You know what happens if you start watching these television programs? you start washing it once, you've got to keep up with what's happening next week. If you start watching what's happening in the American election, you've got to watch again, find out what's happened, find out what's happened next. It's just like a soap opera. If you never turn it on once, you don't even think about it. So it actually imprisons you. Once you get into the system of owning property, you're getting into a jail, whole cycle of getting more, and insurance, worrying about whether it's going to be stolen, getting it better, bigger, replacing it, getting a car, servicing it, making sure it's not stolen. You get into a prison. So freedom is actually convenience, is earning very little. So all those things in the world, they say your home conveniences, I call them home inconveniences. Your washing machine. It doesn't take that much to wash your clothes by hand. And you don't have to worry when the washing machine doesn't work. So these are home inconveniences. Even when I was actually a student, I was, because there's a lot of people who are environmentally conscious. In England, it was proved quite easily that if you use taxis and public transport, you know, all your life, using a taxi was much, much cheaper than running a car. And if you live mostly in the cities, and I'm sure that even in Melbourne, if you actually worked out how much it costs to run your car and keep your car, that if you just, whenever you wanted to go to the shops, just called a taxi, and then I'm sure it would actually cost less. Anyway, that's something else altogether. So I say, I would vote for Life A, the person who becomes a monk or not. That's why those of you who have heard me talk before, sort of, you know, it's almost like you come to one of my treats, it's like a recruitment campaign. Try and get more people to become monks and nuns. Because you get so much happiness out of it myself. And you see just what it can give to the world. You know, to be a very good monk or a very good nun. You do so much for others. And it's sort of lifestyle which I'm really trying to encourage. What this world needs is not more doctors, not more engineers. What this world needs is more monks, more nuns. Good quality monks, good quality nuns. Think about that. Especially those of you who've got children. Don't sort of, you know, when they're finishing their degrees, think, no, go and get a job. You say, go and get a job without your bum. Okay, next question. Any comments about that? Yes?
How does one go about explaining to one's family that life A is better than life B? Because life A doesn't reward the family with children, doesn't reward the family with lots of time to get to that shelter.
What you reward the family with is with understanding pain and suffering, freeing them from the fear of death, knowing that their son or daughter is both happy and giving so much to the world. Parents get very proud of you if they see you helping so many people, and people coming up and bowing to you and telling you that you've saved their life, you helped them so much. And the parents say, is that my son? Is that my daughter? And they feel so much happiness. So parents can get very proud of you, and very lots of warm feeling when they know how much that you're doing for the world. Many other lifetimes they've already had you to play with, and when you were a little boy. Now, sort of, haven't they had enough of little children? If they really like little children and want to play with more, then they should go work in a day school. A daycare centre, or something like that. But you can explain, at first maybe your parents might be a bit sort of suspicious. Oh. But when you actually see the results of a good monk, a good nun, you give so much to them. There'll come a time when your parents are in trouble with a death or with their own imminent demise. And that's the time, above all, when they'll call upon you and lean on your wisdom and lean on your understanding and compassion. At such times, you are just such a gift to your parents. This happens so often that parents who thought their children wasted their time becoming monks or nuns, and something happens in their family, usually a death. And then they realize what their child has been doing all this time. They value it so much. So that's how I'd explain it. It's a marvelous career choice. Okay, next question. How does one use, and don't mind about, it's only not young people who become monks and nuns. There's no age limit. 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 110. The time was about 120, someone became a monk. So don't think it's for somebody else. It's you who can become monks. Yeah, we don't do that. Don't give it like an age limit. If the person is committed, you've got to judge each person. Some of you are like 20-year-olds. They're so sickly you wouldn't want to be in a monastery. Some 50, 60-year-olds, they're great. It really depends upon the purpose, not the person. So we don't have a hard and fast rule. There's no hard and fast rule in the vineyard either. Yes, not in the Vinaya, not in the time of the Buddha. Sometimes very old people became monks and nuns. How does one use whatever concentration one has for insight, or does insight just arise? Both are true. Very often insights just arise when you're least expecting them. There's these lovely stories. I usually tell these towards the end of the retreat. But I'm going to tell it now, just in case a few of you are getting a bit depressed. One of the favourite nuns, she told her story in the Terigata. She'd been meditating for 7 years as a nun. Not just a few days, 7 years. And she hadn't got any peace whatsoever in her meditation. And she was really fed up. I mean, really mean fed up. She got a rope and went into the forest and tied one end of the rope around a big tall branch and tied the other one around her neck. She was going to commit suicide. And she was just about to jump off when she had the insight. She let go and her mind was freed. Now, I wouldn't try to encourage that. Otherwise I'd get in trouble. And the other one, a similar story, the famous disciple Ananda. Just after the Lord Buddha died, they're going to have a huge meeting of all the arahats to bring all the teachings together, what everyone had heard. But because Ananda had listened to so many of the teachings, has such a good memory, all the other arahats decided to let him in, even though he wasn't fully enlightened. And there were 499 arahats except him. Now imagine that was you. Go to a meeting tomorrow morning. He was proud, and he was so embarrassed. So he decided, right, this is it, tonight, enlightenment or bust. And he meditated all night, not going to sleep, sitting and walking. And when it got to dawn, he was getting nowhere. And he again felt so depressed, he decided, what's the point? He decided just to have a rest before the meeting started, at dawn. So he went to lie down. And as soon as he lay down, there, insight came and he became an arahat. You know why insight came then? Because he wasn't expecting anything, he wasn't anticipating anything. He let go. He gave up. Gave up doing, gave up controlling. They're two very powerful stories, because this is what stops us getting into peaceful meditation, what stops us getting insight. Because we try too hard. And there he was, let go. The nun just gave up trying. Put a rope around her neck, give up, let go. That letting go is very powerful. But you do need to have some effort, first of all. That's why with insight I give like the simile of a donkey. With a donkey, how do you get a donkey to move? Yes, you tie a stick to its neck and you dangle a carrot in front. Okay? And of course, the donkey goes after the carrot. You've all seen this before. but you haven't heard Ajahn Brahm's donkey. This is a smart donkey. So it keeps walking, and as soon as it walks, the carrot walks ahead of it. If it runs, the carrot runs ahead of it. No matter how the donkey moves, the carrot, because it's on the end of a stick, is always in front of it. Now the smart donkey can catch it this way. The donkey runs as fast as he can. And even though he's running really fast, the carrot's still up ahead, moving at the same speed. But then the smart donkey stops. He stops very quickly. And the carrot moves away from him because of the momentum. If you stop, the carrot's moving away. But the donkey is wise. He's patient, which is what you have to be, is to work. The carrot moves even further away from him. But then he patiently waits. And then the carrot comes back. Right into the mouth. That's how a wise donkey catches a carrot. So you put all this effort into the meditation or into the practice, and then you stop. As soon as you stop and let go, the first thing when you let go, everything sort of gets, the Dharma goes even further away from you. You're patient. And the carrot comes to you. You don't go to the carrot. If you try and go to the carrot moves away. It's a nice simile, that, because there's lots of Dhamma in that sort of little metaphor. But so often we actually seek for insights, and it's like going after the carrot, and we sort of never get anywhere. Insights just arise. They arise because we have these powerful experiences. And if we get the really powerful experiences, I was saying this morning, they're traumas. You remember that you can't miss them, you can't discard them, they're the most powerful experiences in your life. Wow, what's that? What does it mean? And it's interesting, the experience of these Sailajanas, that what will happen if you haven't got the teachings of the Buddha, you haven't heard them, haven't got someone to explain it, you can very easily misinterpret these jhanas. That's why it's fascinating to actually to compare experiences in meditation in the different religions and how they interpret it. In Christianity, medieval mystical Christianity, when somebody got into a first jhana, like John of the Cross or Teresa of Avila, they thought it was union with God. If any of you ever get into one of those states, you'll understand why they thought that. They were gone. The doer had disappeared. Now, Teresa or John of the Cross, whoever they thought they were, they completely changed, and it was just bliss and power. The most powerful thing they've ever seen. Those of you who got close and were afraid, you can understand why. Terrifying power of, you know, the unification of the mind. And they're not there. And there's bliss, not able to do anything, selfless. And when they come out afterwards, wow, that was God. As a Buddhist monk, though, you know, oh, that was just first jhana. Well, you can really say just, because these are powerful states. But you know sort of what they are. And once you can actually give them a perspective, give them a framework to work from, you can understand what they're doing. Why is it like that? And you reflect back on those states, and you get so much insight from them. The more powerful, unworldly the states, the more you understand. I was telling someone the other day, even this morning, sorry, for that this type of insight into the nature of being, the nature of life. I usually use a simile of the tadpole in the pond. Because a tadpole is born in the pond and grows up in the pond, it can never get any insight into the nature of water. It can never know what water is, because it's always there. And it's only when, even like other frogs come along and say, yeah, water's wet and land is dry. You think, oh yeah, you know, that's just religious dogma. I don't believe in that. But then it comes to one time when the tadpole grows its legs and just wanders out of the pond. It experiences dry land for the first time. Only through the experience of dry land can you know what wetness is. Without that, there's no way. All the thinking in the world, all the intelligence in the world cannot penetrate the truth of witness until that you've got out beyond that. You cannot penetrate the truth of suffering until you've gone out of that pond, at least mostly out of that pond. The jhanas are actually just like the frog walking out the pond but still being wet on the outside, still carrying a little bit of water with him, but knowing enough to be able to understand what wetness is, what suffering is. That's actually why these things are necessary for insight. So, you actually thought, suggested, that once you get a deep meditation, to reflect back on it afterwards. What was that? Why was that? How does this fit into the Four Noble Truths? Anatta, Anicca, what does these actually mean? The Anicca of the Anapanasati Sutta, Viraga fading away, Nirodha cessation, what does that word really mean? The cessation of things? Patinissaga, giving things away, what does that really mean? When you have something to work on, you can understand the meaning of these words. And if you look at those experiences in that framework, then the insights will arise. And in particular, if you look upon those experiences in the framework of the Satipatthana, then you're really getting somewhere. That's a powerful tool. Look at the body. Where did the body go? It's completely gone. There you see Anicca and Nirodha, cessation of the body from the jhanas. Vedana, this happiness and suffering with the senses. Why is this the most blissful experience you've ever had in your life? Because sight, sound, smell, taste and touch are suffering. Even the most beautiful is suffering. If you have those understanding of the jhanas, then sexuality, you're not interested in that anymore. You have a higher happiness. You realize those things burn. Letting go of all of that is cool. This is not theory, this is experience. When you see that mind, you understand what citta is. In particular, you see that citta is not a self. Is that empty of a self? Once you can see that citta and be with it for a while in jhanas, you've got a chance of understanding what it is. You say it's a process, but that's just a theory, but you actually see it and be with it and are it for a while, you can see its non-self nature. The cittanupassi is for seeing the emptiness of the mind. There's the process. And the dhammas, especially that particular mental formation of will, to use that fourth satipatthana to see that chetana is not you. You did not decide to come here. You do not decide to meditate because you aren't there. So that's how you can use these deep meditations to getting insights. Vajra Brahma, the amount I can let go in daily life, is it equal to how much I can let go in meditation and vice versa? Thank you. That's an excellent question. You can't say the amount, but the more you let go in daily life, the easier it is to let go in meditation. The easier it is to let go in meditation, the easier it is to let go in daily life. Because when you let go in meditation, you have all this happiness and peace and understanding, what you've always been searching for. And if that is a foundation, then all those things in daily life which you think are so important to you, you can have them if you wish, but they're not necessary anymore. If you can let go of meditation, you're not so interested in watching the TV. You're not so interested in going out and spending all your money at seeing movies. Now why watch a movie when you can just watch your mind? So you can save a lot of money by learning meditation. If you let go of the past and the future, then you, in meditation, you don't need to go to a therapist in daily life. You can be perfectly at ease and peace. And usually your health gets very strong. You don't need to eat health food if you've got good meditation. So the amount you let go of meditation really helps your daily life. And the amount you can let go in daily life. You know, in daily life, if you can't give up, say, smoking, you can't give up sort of drinking alcohol, which you know is not necessary and doesn't do you any good, And how can you let go of some of these defilements and hindrances in meditation, which are even more refined? So be wise in your daily life. Don't discipline for the sake of discipline, but for let go for the sake of happiness and peace. See how you can make your daily life more happy, more peaceful. Very good question. Any comments on that? Okay. Venerable Sir, can you give a brief explanation on the Noble Eightfold Path? Elaborate on right view and wrong view, please. A brief explanation of the Noble Eightfold Path. Brief is very difficult. The right view is first of all just based on faith. There's something inside of us which hears the Buddhist teachings and intuitively feels that there's something important in this, and it feels right to us. That faith is usually just a resonance from memories of previous lives. You've been here before, you've done this before, and this is just something which is feels good because you know it from the past. That right view in your next life is being built now. It starts just with a faith in meditation, with precepts, with the idea of a Buddha, with the idea of rebirth and karma. And that starts your right view off. Only from that right view can one actually start to practice and turn that faith into experience. A very beautiful simile for this from the suttas, which actually shows how the Eightfold Path works as a way to Nibbana. There's the simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. And it's a beautiful simile of the Buddha. The first shipwrecked sailor, as soon as he jumps in the water, goes right down. Never comes up again. That's one who's got bad sila. You know, never keeps precepts, very selfish, hurtful to others. The second shipwrecked sailor goes down and bobs up again, and then goes down again, and then bobs up again. That's the usual person in this world. You know, they do good things, they do bad things. The average Joe and Jenny. They bob up and bob down. The third shipwrecked sailor floats, always above the water. This is the people who keep five precepts. I wasn't going to say this is a Buddhist, because some Buddhists do not keep their five precepts. They'll go down sometimes. And some Christians will keep good precepts. So if you keep good sila, you stay up. And only if you stay up can you be like the fourth sailor, shipwrecked sailor. But because they're staying above the water, looks around and sees the shore, sees safety. They see the Dhamma. That fourth shipwrecked sailor is called the stream winner, who's got right view, perfect right view, enough to be able to see the goal, see Nirvana, see freedom. Only that fourth shipwrecked sailor can progress to be the fifth shipwrecked sailor, once returner. And this is the sailor who, having seen where the shore is swimming. It's getting closer and closer and closer. This is the once returner who's actually got right view and is actually doing something about it. If right view tells you that you should let go, then the shipwrecked sailor in this once returner is letting go. He's simplifying, giving things away, lightening the burden, practicing meditation, getting deeper and deeper concentrations, and making that view which he has more and more strong. And the sixth shipwrecked sailor, he swam so close to the shore that now you can stand up and you're wading to the shore. There's just the surf just around your ankles always. That's the sixth shipwrecked sailor, the anagami, the non-returner. They're just so close that there's hardly any difference between the anagami and the seventh shipwrecked sailor. Has actually got onto the beach and is sitting under a coconut tree safe. The seven shipwrecked sailors. So right view, the real right view, not the faith right view, the right view which is the perfect right view, is that of a stream winner. That's when you see the complete emptiness of this mind, that the knower consciousness has got no core to it. That's why consciousness can cease completely. That's why you're not worried anymore about going to a black hole, because you know there's no one there in the first place. What are you worried about losing? There was nothing there to lose. The doer, you see, the doer is not me either. It's just a process, cause and effect. So you're not so concerned about doing anymore. That right view of seeing anatta, seeing dukkha. It's not just seeing that when I don't get what I want, it's dukkha. When I don't get the nice food I like, or having a pain in my knee, or not hearing the talks I want to hear. But hearing anything is dukkha. Seeing anything is dukkha. Thinking is dukkha. Feeling is dukkha. The whole works is dukkha. Only then can you allow all of this conscious process to go to cessation. You've got no reason for holding on to it anymore. And you see anicca. You see things actually can cease. Not things out there, not what's on the television set, but the television set itself, the screen of consciousness. You understand that that disappears as well. So that's the right view.
What conditions
stream winning? Very good question. Two things condition stream winning. Both have to be there. It's fascinating, this. It's the words of another and the work of the mind, which goes back to the source of things. You can't do it by yourself. Very beautiful. This is the Mahavedana Sutta. Paragosa, the words of another. This is where you need the teachings of a Buddha or the teachings of an Arya. Because the way of our conditioning, that if we only sort of listen to other Putujanas, this is non-enlightened beings, non-stream winners, that actually we can't do anything. We need someone else actually to give us a seed of a different way of looking at things to jolt us out of our avijja, of our delusion. And that's why you needed a Buddha to get this whole sasana going, this whole religion of Buddhism going. And either you've got to have the teachings of the Buddha, the texts, or you have to have a monk, a nana teacher who's realized those teachings to also provide that seed. Otherwise, stream winning is impossible. You can't do it by yourself. There are Pacheka Buddhas around. They're very, very, very rare. They're anomalies. But that's what they said, the reasons why you become a stream winner. There are the supporting factors for stream winning. Those are the main causes. But the supporting factors, why is it that when the Buddha taught some people, even though they're intelligent, they could use their minds wisely, they didn't become enlightened, or they didn't become stream winners? Because the supporting things weren't there. And there's five supporting qualities, which if they're very strong, means that when you hear the words from an Arya and you use the mind properly, stream winning happens. Those five supporting qualities, first of all, a sila, your virtue, your precepts. Secondly, sutta. Literally means your hearing. It's a word in Pali which meant your learning. So you've learned the Buddha's teachings. You've heard them before, you understand them. Or rather, the third one, sakaccha, is discussion, questioning. So that what you hear, you question, just to make sure you understand it correctly. That's why I like doing these questions, because this is part of the supporting factors which give rise to stream winning. First one, sila. Second, sutta. Third one, sakaccha. Virtue, learning, questioning. The fourth and fifth ones, samatha, vipassana. Two together make the fourth and fifth factors. If you have all those five factors very strong, now you have a good sila, and you've done some study, so you understand what the basic Buddhist teachings are, and you've discussed it with other people, so you You know, you haven't misunderstood things, and you've been practicing samatha, vipassana, both of those, with calm states of mind, insight based on those calm states of mind. Then, with those five things very strong, when an arya comes along and starts teaching, or you read some of the suttas, and you start working on them, then you've got a great chance to become a stream winner. It makes so much sense. If you've got very weak sila, you know, you're just not keeping precepts, is, you know, snowball's chance in hell, as they say, of becoming a stream winner. You have to have those precepts, have to have precepts strong. Even if you keep precepts, but you haven't actually even studied any Buddhism, you don't know the words or know what the Four Noble Truths is all about, again, you haven't got much chance. Because the Sutta Sakaccha, you know, the intellectual understanding, gives you the framework, gives you the map, the guidebook, so that when you get to the territory, you can understand your way around. But having all the precepts and all the intellectual knowledge, unless you actually do something and practice it, the samatha vipassana, again, there's no way you can get stream winning. With all five together, and you get sort of someone giving a really good talk, and you reflect on that talk, then the likelihood is that you're going to get something. Good question. Yeah?
Before you said that
Indian
has to be an Aryan.
Yep. And if.
How do you know that Indian is an Aryan?
You can't, because they're not allowed to tell you. So if you really want to be absolutely sure, the Buddha was an Aryan. And we've got these wonderful translations now of the suttas. We've got the beautiful one done by Maurice Walsh, a Diga Nikaya. The ones done by Bhikkhu Bodhi of the Majjhima Nikaya and the Samyutta Nikaya is out now. So, look through those.
So, if
a
teacher says he's an Aryan, so can we talk
to
him?
No.
Can we talk to him?
No, you can't. Because that's breaking the rules.
Oh,
the Bhagavad Gita? This is the only way you can find out. You can't ask that monk or that nun. You can ask their best friend. Hey, you know that monk over there, is he? What is he? That's the way around. But it's best they don't say anything, because once any word gets around about attainments, then it gives rise to, very often, to jealousy. What? Him? What? Her? Not me? Instead of actually giving rise to, like, mudita, the right joy that someone's actually got something. Isn't that wonderful? No. Yeah, he was, yes, but sort of he laid down the rules afterwards that you can only declare your attainments to other monks or other nuns. And there's good reason behind that, because, for example, one reason behind this, Ajahn Chah was regarded by many people to be an arahat. And if you're giving alms or charity to like an arya, or especially to an arahat, that's much, much more merit than giving it to an ordinary monk. It's like, you know, where you're going to invest your money. You invest it in like a high-tech stock a few years ago, you got made millions, and invest it in sort of something else, and you lost your money. So no one invests their money where it gets the maximum return. So they always like giving food to arahats. So it happened quite often in Wat Pa Phong, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, there were maybe 50 monks and 50 nuns there. And the food, I've already said how disgusting it was. Every now and again, someone would come from town with reasonably decent. It wasn't still not very nice, but at least it was more edible than frogs. And I remember on many occasions, you know, just saliva going when you saw a truck come from town. And they had all these pots and pans and nice curries and sweets and fruit on the back. And seeing the driver come out and say, "Is Ajahn Chah here today?" "No, he's gone out for a dine in someone's house." And see the car turn around and go. That was really awful. As a young monk who liked his food. But it happened because they didn't really feel it was worthwhile offering their food just to ordinary monks and ordinary nuns. It wasn't a good enough investment. So you could see that sometimes keep it quiet. So that all the monks are looked upon as, and all, Okay, all nuns, all okay, even. And then you don't get sort of preferences for who gives given the most gifts and who gets the most food. Sometimes, but not always. Sometimes they see that maybe there might be sort of, you know, they look down and there's one monk or one nun who's got a bit of a reputation down there in the line. So, not always a senior. That's one of the reasons why. And the other thing is, if you actually go around telling people you've got something, some people just like to go and test you out and make sure you're not. So a lot of times people come out to Ajahn Chah to try and sort of make him angry or to test him out just to prove that he wasn't really enlightened. And people do that. And so, you know, if you are enlightened, this is a Taiwanese nun once said this, if you're ever enlightened, don't tell anybody, because if you tell someone, the word will get around and you have to spend the rest of your life proving it. It's actually quite neat advice, that. So with psychic powers, if you ever develop psychic powers, don't show it to anybody. Because if you did, you'd get Channel 9 and Channel 7 trying to sort of offer you donations for your nuns' monastery, if you could just levitate just once on camera, please. Or whatever else it is. Because people like to see weird things. And so, say, just become a freak. Yeah? Indeed, the intention is a major thing. But the intention is not just the motive, it's also the goal as well. And if it's the intention, if it's a wise intention, it realizes if you're going to plant a mango, if you plant the mango seed in good soil, it's going to get many more mangoes for you than if you plant it in sort of dry soil or rocky soil. There's no sort of fertilizer in it. So the chaitanya, the karma, is important, but there's other factors as well. The chaitanya, the intention, is the most important. There are other factors as well. So the Buddha said that, and I can understand that if your intention is to do something good, the intention is like to help that boy get his sight back, but you haven't got the wisdom to ask him, first of all, do you want the sight back? The intention is pure, but the karma sort of doesn't give as much as if you really were wise and say whether you want your sight back. The Boy Scout who helps an old lady across the road, his intention is very good, but he should really ask, first of all, whether she wants to go across the road. So there is sort of, you know, something else more than just intention, but intention is the major quality. Does that make sense? It's a good question.
Yeah. If they turn stuff around and run away too, that's very bad.
Absolutely, yeah.
Not because
you're
hungry,
it's
really bad.
Well, it's not really bad, but it's bad. It's very good. It's very good for me. For me, it was very good. Anyway, let's go to the next question. What is the Buddhist view of what is happening to the mind in mental illness? What are the conditions which create this? Another good question. With mental illness, sometimes that it is karmically caused from the past. You know, if one has done a lot of cruelty in the past, sometimes that creates a sense of, you know, guilt, which even, you know, you tell people to let go, they just can't do it. And the remorse can send you crazy. What we look upon as mental illness in Buddhism is anything where there's greed, hatred and delusion. So it's only arahats are beyond mental illness. Absolutely. You said it, not me. It is crazy, isn't it? I mean, why did you spend all your life sort of working so hard and getting a nice house when in the end all you need is a piece of wood 6 foot long, 2 foot wide? Now, what did you get married for? You should know better than that. It's actually crazy. That's what I say about, you know, falling in love is complete craziness. Everyone knows that. But a lot of people are still waiting for the next relationship so they can fall in love all over again. They're just addicted to mental illness. Anger. There's a lovely story by Ajahn Chah of how to overcome anger. There was this man who had the afternoon off his work, living in a village, and his wife was very busy, you know, cooking the evening meal, and she needed some eggs. So she asked her husband, "Darling, can you please, you know, you've got the afternoon off, can you go into the next village where the market is and buy me sort of half a dozen eggs?" "Yeah, sure, no worries at all." So he didn't need to go to the market or buy any eggs, so she had to tell him where to go, gave him a basket and some money, and off he went. As soon as he got to the other village and went into the market, this man came up to him and called him a fool, called him an idiot, called him ugly. His nose was too big, and he called him really more abusive things than that. And the husband said, "But what's your problem? You know, I don't even know you." But no matter what the husband said, it just made this man even more angry and more abusive. And this man got so upset and so angry at this abusive man that he sort of turned around and went home. And when he got back home, his wife said, "You were quick, dear. Have you got the eggs?" And he said, "No." I'm just so upset and so angry. And this person came up to me to call me all these terrible names. "I haven't done anything. It's really unfair. What have I done to hurt him that he could say such rotten things to me?" And when he calmed down a bit, so his wife said, "Darling." And so the wife said, "Oh, it's him." She recognized the description and said, "Look, he does that to everybody. He does that to me. He does that to the neighbors. He's crazy. When he was a young boy, he had an accident and fell on his head. And ever since then, this is just what he does. You know, he's a bit sort of, you know, not a full quid." When he heard that, sort of his anger disappeared. And so his wife said, "Look, I really need those eggs. I'm too busy to go myself. Can you go back there and get the eggs? And don't mind about him. He's just crazy, the poor thing. He's got mental illness." So he went back to the market. And as soon as he got into the marketplace again, this man came up to him once more and started abusing him and telling him all sorts of rotten things. But he was crazy, the poor fellow. So the man husband never got angry. He went right out to the counter, and even as he was buying the eggs, this man was calling him all sorts of terrible names. And the man smiled at the lady selling the eggs and said, "He's crazy." And the lady said, "Yeah, he does this to me sometimes as well, poor thing. You know, he fell on his head when he was young." And when he was walking out with the eggs, this man was abusing him again. But he never got upset because he knew the guy was crazy. And so when the Buddha told that story, he said, "If anyone abuses you, just think of them as crazy. And then you won't get upset. If your husband tells you off and starts scolding you, it's just temporary insanity, that's all. So there's no need to get upset about it. If someone calls you an idiot or fool, oh, that's mental illness." That's a lovely way of getting over anger. Because sometimes when people tell us off, you know, we take it seriously. So I can tell you a little story there, what mental illness is. When people say rotten things about you, that is mental illness. So you just say, "Oh, they're crazy. They must have fallen on their head this morning." But the other type of mental illness is, again, so often these are karmic, but also they are anicca. Always separate the illness from the person. It's a temporary thing that the person's in. And also that sometimes that what is called mental illness is just a temporary, not seeing things very clearly, a temporary sort of depression, temporary self-hate. The important thing is, don't actually call it sort of, that you are schizophrenic, or you are manic depressive, or you are something like that. Because if you don't say you are that, you know, it becomes a personality, it becomes a label, and actually tend to live up to those labels. It's like a psychologist in Singapore recently was telling me, if you live between a parent, when their child sort of, you know, drops the eggs and they all smash on the floor, instead of calling them, "You clumsy child," You say that that was a clumsy thing you did. The difference is, if you call them a clumsy child, I mean they are clumsy. And that's them. You say that's a clumsy thing you do, you're separating the child from the act. It's just one act you did amongst many, which was clumsy. The other acts are okay. And the child doesn't feel as bad. Sometimes the words we use insensitively can create terrible impressions. Someone makes a mistake, you idiot. There's a lot of difference saying, you idiot, than that was an idiotic thing you did. So mental illness is just, that was a mentally ill thing you did, but you are not mentally ill. And there's a difference there. It gives the opportunity for a person to get out of that mental illness. It's not them. There are just some thoughts about mental illness and being clumsy. Ajahn, perhaps thanks to the priest who conducted your father's funeral, we have a great teacher like you. Did it make you look out for other religions? Question, is there a time gap between Sotapanna-magga and Sotapanna-pala? Okay. We'll make you look out for other religions. It's a strange thing that when you first get into Buddhism, sometimes you can sort of lack respect for other religions. But the more one actually practices, and one can see sort of something to respect in all people. And if they're a Buddhist or not a Buddhist, if they're a stream winner or a puttichana or whatever they are, you respect everybody. Because it's just a matter of time before you can see the Dharma, see the stream winner. Is there a time gap between Sotapanna-magga and Sotapanna-pala? There certainly is gaps between these things, time gaps. It's a really weird thing that the commentaries, especially Abhidharma, started to have the idea that Sotapanna-magga, the path of stream winning, precedes only by a moment or two the fruit of stream winning. The evidence in the suttas is so strong that there's a difference here. Even to the point they say that a person who is on the path to stream winning, that they have to get the fruit before they die. Even to the point that if they're really, really slow and the eon is about to end, that the eon has to wait for them. The big crunch or whatever else it has to wait for them to become stream winners. And they even got a word for it in Pali which actually means one who holds up the eon. So the point is that yes, the path precedes the fruit by a long time usually. They've even got words for it. There's the two people who are on the path of being stream winning. They're the Sadhanusari and the Dhammanusari. The Sadhanusari is the one who's going on faith. They've got so much faith in the teaching of the Buddha that they take it just for granted that this is what they've got to do. If the Buddha said it, it must be right. And if you had that degree of faith, then you'd all be monks and nuns. That's the Buddha praised people becoming monks and nuns, didn't they? You all know that. Anyone who reads the suttas, you know it's a good thing to give lots of charity. Keeping five precepts would be absolute. Because the Buddha praised five precepts. You wouldn't doubt it. If you really had faith, you'd do that. So how much faith have you got? If you really had faith, you would come to meditation retreats. All those Buddhists out there who didn't come today, you know, they're sadhā. It's not because they've got important things to do. They've got to look after their family. They've got to go to work. They've got faith in work, not faith in Buddhism. So that degree of faith, a really strong faith, makes you a sadhanasari. That's what the Buddha said, you do it, you're going to get to where the Buddha said you're going to get to. The other one is the dhammanasari, who goes mostly through understanding. Instead of the faith, you reflect upon these, and your understanding, your wisdom is so strong, you see so much of what the Buddha saw. Not complete yet, but enough that you're going to go in that direction. You've got the glimpse of the shore. The other one is just going on faith. The Buddha said the shore is that way, that's the way I'm going to go. So those are the two who are actually on the path of being stream winners. And it means they're going to get there without any problem. But it takes time. So there certainly is, and it's impossible to actually to hold that they're just one moment from each other. Where that idea actually came from, who knows, but it doesn't fit with the Buddha's teachings.
Any questions on that?
It's a technical point, but... How does one deal with negative emotions that sometimes arise in meditation without repressing them, such as ill will towards another person? Thank you. If it's a negative emotion which sometimes arises, if it arises and you catch it very quickly, it's easy just to let it go. Not now. Especially ill will towards another person. Ill will towards another person starts with a little irritation. Now they cough. Just about when you're about to get into jhanas. They've got no right to do this. Why do they do this? They shouldn't do this. And it's the thoughts afterwards which create the real ill will and the negative emotions. You cherish and encourage and nurture. If you can actually catch a negative emotion when it first arises, it's so easy to stop. So similarly, I've given before of the sapling. If it's a weed, when it's a small weed, it's easy to take out. Like Patterson's curse, for example. If you allow that weed to take over year after year, it's almost impossible. You're too late. So negative emotions are very easy if you are quick with your mindfulness. If you're not quick with the mindfulness, then when they arise, you've got to use some sort of substitution or just even use your wisdom power. You know, to know that, so why am I having ill will towards this person? Really, it's nothing they've done. It's my fault if I've got ill will. It's just like I say that driving in the, being driven in the monastery car in Perth, sometimes you get to the traffic lights, the red traffic lights, and I look through the window and there's someone getting really angry at the red traffic lights. You can almost read their minds. You saw me coming, didn't you, traffic lights? You knew I was in a hurry. You let the car in front of me go through, but you stopped for me. This is unfair. And they get angry at the red traffic lights. Have you ever got angry at traffic lights? Do you think the traffic lights have got, so, you know, like a soul inside them or a stream of consciousness that actually did do it on purpose? They're just being the nature of traffic lights, that's all. So why do you get angry at your husband? You did this on purpose, didn't you, husband? A husband just being a husband, that's all, just like the traffic lights. It's not their fault at all. Or the person sitting next to you. They cough, that's what people do when they've got a throat. So why get angry at them for? So when you actually understand that it's just the nature of people to be irritating, even our hearts are irritating sometimes. Ajahn Chah certainly was irritating sometimes. And so you don't get angry at him, because it's like getting angry at a mountain. That's just what mountains do. So this is actually how you overcome the negative emotions, just by realizing that there's no rational foundation behind them. And you're just hurting yourself. So you don't repress them. You let them go when they're very small. You understand them when they're very big, and you use wisdom to overcome them. Here it is. Why am I doing this? This is stupid. And when you actually see the stupidity behind them, so the cause behind them, it's like cutting off the fuel supply. They all go. Can you please elaborate a little more on the 14th to 16th stages of the breath? Is this what is called dhammas in dhammas? Okay, talking about the Satipatthana here and the last bit of the Anapanasati Sutta, actually should be really the 13th to 16th, I think they mean, the Anicca, a reflection on Anicca, when you're breathing in, breathing out, reflecting Anicca, breathing in, breathing out, reflecting Viraga. Sometimes that's called dispassion, but in this context it means the fading away of things. Breathing in, breathing out, contemplating Nirodha cessation. Breathing in, breathing out, contemplating Patinissaga, giving up. It's not dhammas in dhammas, the four Satipatthana, it's all the Satipatthanas. Seeing the Satipatthana of the body being anicca can disappear, and the body has disappeared for you, It's faded away. It faded away from being very solid to just having the subtle breath, the beautiful breath left, and then it disappeared altogether. It eroded. It ceased for you. And Patinissaga, because you just gave it up, you let go. And that's the body contemplation. The Vedana, you see, all these Vedana of the five senses completely disappearing. You're left with this beautiful Vedana of the mind. You see the Chitta. You see the Chitta, the anicca of the Chitta, the fading away of Chitta. You can even see that Chitta will cease only in Nibbana. And you can Patinissaga, you can let go of consciousness. And you see the Dhammas, especially the four Satipatthana. So these last four stages sort of are the same as the four Satipatthanas. They overlap. It's what you do after you've got the jhanas and come out afterwards. It's the reflection. Does that answer the question? Okay, next one. Is the amount of bliss, peace and level of jhana one reaches related consequence of karma? Thank you. I suppose you might say it is mostly related to the immediate karma, what you've been doing a few minutes ago. And especially how much letting go you've been doing. The level of bliss of the nimittas is more important because that shows how much energy, how much happiness you have in the mind. And if you are light-hearted, you have happiness because of some karma you've done. If you've done an act of charity and you recall that, isn't that what a wonderful thing you did? And then that gives rise to bliss. We make good karma. We've got all this store of good karma in the bank. But we don't know how to turn the store of good karma into bliss here and now. And that is why I give the simile, it's like having lots of money in the bank, but we've forgotten the PIN number, so we can't get it out of the ATM. And these are the PIN numbers. First stage, second stage, third stage, fourth stage. And also with the recollection of your good karma. Recall it, think about it, dwell upon it. Don't just like leave it there and say, I shouldn't even think about this. I get proud of myself. If you've done an act of good karma, you've kept precepts, you've done a meditation retreat, good on you. Practice, praise yourself, feel good about yourself. It's excellent karma. Keeping eight precepts for how many, 8 days, that's more good karma than if you gave $1 billion to every monastery in the world. There's heaps of bliss in there. I just feel like that. When I get tired sometimes working in my monastery in Perth, or just talking to people all day, and I want to do some meditation, you know how I overcome that tiredness? I start thinking what I've done today, and the people I've served, and how much I've given, and the quality of what I've given. And when I start doing that, my eyes start getting watery. And I start feeling this beautiful piti sukha coming up in the heart. And then all my tiredness disappears. You can have good meditation. I know the PIN numbers. When I make merit, I use it. So this is actually how you can actually increase the level of your piti sukha in your meditation. Think of the charity work you've done. And the food you've offered to good monks over the years. The donations you've given to monasteries over the years, the great teachers you've looked after, even you've just given them a cup of tea. Think about that and how wonderful that is. And then that really makes you bliss out. Wow, amazing. You got me so getting high now. And I think what I've been doing. Rajan, being a good Buddhist, giving dhanas, giving donations, and try to keep the five precepts, would that eventually help one to be a good meditator and attain nibbana in this life? Absolutely. That's your energy source. That's the fuel. If you start to use that fuel and turn on the engine, and vroom, 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 then you go. The thing is that every one of you has made heaps of good karma in the past, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
All you really need now is to, to use that energy. You've got enough fuel in the tank, so stop messing around. Get off to Nirvana. Next question. If an illiterate person begins to meditate and on breathing without having to manufacture the stage of breathing meditation, will he or she reap the same benefit by getting into jhanas, etc.? Just turn over. Please define jhana in more detail. Thank you. If an illiterate person begins to meditate on breathing, I think what they really mean is someone who doesn't think so much, who hasn't got that sort of mind which does well at school, and who begins to meditate without having to manufacture the stage of breathing meditation. Everyone has to manufacture, you have to create these things, in the sense of you have to develop them. Say develop instead of manufacture. But they'll be able to do it much easier because they don't think so much. You all know, you've meditated long enough now to know how thinking so much always gives a lot of trouble to meditation. So a simple-minded person can get into simple meditation and get very deep very quickly. So they can get into jhanas very quickly, but what the trouble is that figuring out what those jhanas means is where they sort of have a hold up. So the person who is stronger with their intellect will have more difficulty getting into meditation, into jhanas, but when they get into meditation, into jhanas, they'll be able to work well to understand it much quicker. In terms of the indriyas, the panindriya of an illiterate person might be very weak, but the samadindriya will be very strong. So the panindriya is the spiritual quality of wisdom. They're slow in wisdom, but they're fast in jhanas. Define jhanas in more detail. Can I leave that to a whole talk? Because to define what the jhanas really are in detail will take a long time, and it's nice to inspire you with a talk towards the end of the retreat. But basically, they're states of bliss where there's no thinking, you cannot hear anything, feel anything in the body, you're in there for a long period of time, and the object which you're aware of is bliss. The piti sukha born of the body and the hindrances completely gone. Just to put in context the quote of Ajahn Chah used last night, okay. When suffering ceases, where do we go to? What are we practicing for? We are practicing to relinquish, not in order to gain anything. There was a woman this afternoon who told me that she is suffering. I asked her what she wants to be, and she said she wants to be enlightened. I said, as long as you want to be enlightened, you will never become enlightened. Don't want anything. Okay, very good. When it's in that context, you can see that she wants to be enlightened rather than she wants to be peaceful. She wants to let go of herself. So it's that aiming for something. It's a good simile of this is when I was at school, I was very rebellious, you know, going to a Christian school, and people started talking about God and said, believing in God, I asked, what actually is this God? Please define God. And of course, you know what happens when you sort of start talking like that, you get into big trouble at Christian schools. But no one would give me a good description of what they believed in. And I thought that was completely irrational. How can you believe in God and commit yourself to believe in God when you don't know what you're believing in? You can't explain it to me, it means you can't explain it to yourself, you don't know. So I became a Buddhist. And I believed in enlightenment. And then I went to all these great monks and said, well, actually, is enlightenment anyway? What is Nirvana? And no one would give me a straight answer. And I started to say, hang on, what's the difference here between believing in God and believing in Nirvana? Do you want to be enlightened? Do you know what enlightenment is? Do you really want not to be reborn again? Really? If I sort of suddenly made a magic wand, so you actually disappear completely? What most people want, they want to go to Nirvana and enjoy it. The enlightenment is some sort of heaven well for them, like some pure land. So they want to go to Nirvana and be happy ever after. All the Sri Lankans want to make sure there's dal in Nirvana. And lots of cups of tea. Otherwise, what's the point? I work so hard, if it's just an Ajahn Brahm's black hole, There's nothing there. What's the point of this? The point was that I noticed as a young man myself, I wanted to be enlightened, but I hadn't got a clue what that was. And that was actually pure stupidity. I wanted something which I couldn't define. And the Buddha once gave a simile of this man who said he'd fallen in love with the most beautiful girl in the country. And he said, well, who is the most beautiful girl in the country? You know, is she... Sorry? Yeah, that's right, yeah. But, I mean, who actually is she? And, has she got blonde hair or long hair or short hair? And this fellow couldn't actually decide or couldn't actually tell, you know, who the most beautiful girl was, not even what village she was in. And it was like a simile. So isn't that falling in love with the most beautiful girl in the country just stupidity when you don't know who she is? Isn't like loving God stupidity when you don't know what God is? Isn't wanting to become enlightened stupidity when you don't even know what enlightenment is? So this is what Ajahn Chah was saying. You want to be enlightened, but what do you want to be? What do you want? You don't even know what enlightenment is. So how can you want to be enlightened? So first of all, find out what this mind is. Find out what enlightenment is. Find out what cessation is. And then you find out if you want to be it or not. It's like in the idea of bodhisattvas. I'm going to pull off my enlightenment to save all other beings. You don't even know what you're putting off. And if you actually knew what enlightenment was, you'd realize just how that was a crazy idea. It's only said by people who haven't got a clue what enlightenment is. There's actually a bit more here. From when we know the truth of suffering, we throw out suffering. When we know the cause of suffering, then we don't create those causes, but instead practice to bring suffering to its cessation. Very good. So it's not a person who becomes enlightened, it's just suffering ends. Suffering ceases. So actually, thank you for whoever wrote this out, because when you put it in the full context, it makes a lot of sense. So it's good to aspire to be peaceful. It's good to aspire to be wise. It's good to aspire to let go. And then, without you realizing, you're aspiring to enlightenment. Any questions on that one? Got two more questions left. If one was alone in nature and the only way to survive was by killing and eating an animal, would it be in bad karma to do so? Likewise, once a farmer realizes the lives of all the little bugs in the ground which he ploughs, is he obliged to stop his livelihood for the sake of his karma? Essentially, my question is, if karma is all about intention, where does intention end and the practice of survival begin? If one was alone in nature and the only way to survive was by killing and eating an animal, sort of, if you were that alone in nature, sort of, I don't think you'd survive anyway without anyone to talk to. It's hard enough on an 8-day retreat. I think what you really mean is that sometimes the hypothetical situations actually never work. They're just like created by thought. You're never alone in nature to that extent. And even if, you know, that actually happened and you were that alone in nature, the only way to survive was killing and eating an animal. Sort of, if it was me, I would just sit down and meditate and just let sort of nature take its course. Now, why kill and eat an animal? Doesn't an animal have as much right to you to survive? Would it be in bad karma to do so? I say, yes, it would be bad karma to do so. I know that sort of sometimes they have this question in Tibetan Buddhism. Suppose there's a whole shipload of people and the captain was about to pull the plug on the ship and sink everybody and scuttle it. But you had a gun, but you were a monk. And you could shoot that captain and save all the crew. But if you didn't shoot the captain, then everyone would die, including you. Surely, they say, it would be good karma to shoot the captain because you saved so many more people. What would you do? That's a good answer. I never thought that one. The thing is, you don't know what the captain's going to do. And that's one of the things with these hypothetical situations. The future is so uncertain. You haven't got a clue what's going to happen. So because of that, sort of, you know, I wouldn't shoot. I'd say, look, I think it's really bad karma to shoot you and shoot anybody. And maybe that might inspire the captain not to do anything. Who knows what someone's going to do? Or a farmer realizes the life of all the bugs on the ground which he ploughs, is he obliged to stop his livelihood for the sake of his karma? Many people actually, when they realize the karma of the lives, they do change their livelihood. Maybe if it's a farmer who ploughs, it's also usually most farmers raise pigs and chickens as well. And perhaps they can change their livelihood, which many people do. But an interesting story about this, there was, it's actually the same man I talked about yesterday who was the local herbal doctor. He actually was one of Ajahn Chah's early disciples. And he went to Ajahn Chah with like a moral dilemma. He had a family. He was very poor. He couldn't afford to buy things. And the only way to feed his family was to catch fish and frogs to eat, because that was just the subsistence livelihood. You know, in Northeast Thailand at that time, you couldn't be a vegetarian because literally there weren't vegetables. It was just fruit in season. They didn't have vegetables. It was rice and whatever crawled, basically. And they would catch fish during the rainy season, the monsoon season, and they would pickle them. And they didn't really pickle them very well either. It was actually called rotting fish, pladek, is what you had to eat. Once, actually, we were cleaning up the monastery one day, and just by the back of the kitchen, we found this jar with these pickled fish in it. It was crawling with maggots. And someone had, you know, left it out there, and so we went to throw it away. And the most refined person in the village headman, happened to be in the monastery, said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Look, it's spoiled, it's full of maggots." He said, "Don't throw it away, that's extra protein." And he took it home with him. And the next day, sort of, I didn't feel like eating my monastery. But that was actually, because that was survival. That's all they had to eat. So they had to eat that sort of stuff. But anyway, this man, poor Ami's name was, he went to Ajahn Chah and said, "I want to keep the five precepts, but how can I keep these? I have to catch fish, otherwise my children will actually die." And you know, what he said was actually true. And so Ajahn Chah said, "Okay, you catch fish and frogs, but just enough to feed your family, but not to sell. And in the meantime, I'll teach you all that I know about herbal medicines, so that eventually you can give up sort of killing fish and you can make your livelihood out of your knowledge of herbs." And that's what he did. It took him a few years, and after those few years he didn't need to catch fish anymore. He'd only made like a survival on the herbal medicines, but he became, you know, an expert in the whole area. And that was a very lovely story, because that was showing that Ajahn Chah's practicality, his wisdom, but his commitment to five precepts. He was actually helping people keep five precepts. But you know, realizing that, you know, a person has to feed their family, it will take a while before the family, before the farmer, can actually find another livelihood. Anyway, last question. "Thank you for this beautiful talk this morning. Thank you once again." This is me. That's not me. And again, just like I'd do that just for fun. "Just like the amount of energy sustain the length of jhana, do we live only for the length of time we bring with karma? So whether the king sends a note asking Ajahn Chah to be kept alive, or as in the case of Professor Jayateleke, one has to go when one's time is up, is it? Or do we make any new karma to extend or shorten our life in this birth?" So our length of life is not completely determined by the karma of previous life. The karma of the previous life, if you like, sort of encourages, or what's the word I'm using? It's forcing this life to a certain time. But you can do karma in this life to shorten or extend your life. So it's not just karma from a past life. Karma from a past life is an important cause. There's also karma in this life as well. As with Professor Jayateleke, it was most of the karma from this life which made him die so young. And with Ajahn Chah is also the karma in this life and previous lives, which determine the length of his life. So even in strange actually, that sometimes this happens to people, they get very close to death, and they know they can choose whether to keep on going or whether to pass away. If you're very, very sick and being that close to death, you know it's just so easy to die, just give up. But sometimes that the karma from this life, you've got something to do. You can actually keep on going for a while. So it's the karma from this life together with the karma from the past life. Depends your length of life. Sometimes even when people get old, they go to the monks to actually do a ceremony to extend their life. they want these life extending ceremonies. And then sometimes you ask, well, what do you want to extend your life for? You're really old anyway. Do you want more sickness and death? That was because, the story yesterday was because he did not look after his health because he believed the fortune teller. That story I told the other day. Okay, well, he went to this fortune teller and the fortune teller told him the name of his future wife. And he never knew a person by that name. It was one of these long Sri Lankan names, so that was really quite an achievement to actually predict a name like that. And anyway, actually I heard this in the newspaper that even in Sri Lanka, apparently, you give your horses these not long names as well. Apparently you do, because it was in one of the, I'm not sure it was a joke, or it was in the newspaper that there was a very close race, and this person was trying to call the horses and had a heart attack and died. Because the nose was so long, and they couldn't get it out fast enough. I read it in the paper, not sure if it's true or not. Anyway. This person was, he believed the fortune teller, and he really believed the fortune teller was had 100% accuracy. And so when the fortune teller told him he'd live to a long life, he'd die of an old age, when he got sick, he never went to the doctor. He never took advice, because he thought he's going to live to an old age, why worry? And if he'd have gone to the doctor, you know, his sickness would have been cured. And that's why he died young. He believed implicitly in the fortune teller. That's why you've got to be very careful with believing in fortune tellers. Okay. Oh. Yeah. Is there any other questions? Going. Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I don't want to get too cerebral. I was just wondering about the idea of fortune telling and this idea of
coming fifth, yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed, but there's sometimes that the karmic forces are so strong that you know that something is almost certainly going to happen. So that there is a sense of fortune telling. However, a story I tell also about fortune telling, as well as the horse which came in fifth. I tell that story just so that people, you know, remember stories like that and they don't trust fortune tellers. But because monks, especially great meditators and arahats, have got such strong minds that sometimes you can predict things. But people would actually go to those monks, go to people like Ajahn Chah, and beg him to tell their fortunes. And once somebody actually went to Ajahn Chah and begged, you know, please Ajahn Chah, I've been looking after you, I've been giving you food, please can you sort of tell my fortune? And so for once, Ajahn Chah gave in. And said, okay, madam, for once I don't usually do this, but I'm going to tell your fortune now. And this lady was just so delighted, because she would never do this to anyone else. She was special. And also, she trusted Ajahn Chah implicitly, that what Ajahn Chah said, it would have to come true. And Ajahn Chah said that, you know, he was going to be 100% accurate. He said, madam, your fortune. She said, yes. He said, your future is uncertain. And he was absolutely right, it was accurate. But she wasn't happy, but all the other monks were laughing. And that was beautiful Dhamma. You want to know your fortune? He's telling your fortune. Uncertain. No one can actually tell you. And that's a real wise fortune teller. You ask what's going to happen tomorrow? Uncertain. No, it's not fate. It's just past karma gives you all those ingredients and is pointing in that direction, but you can change at any time. So, like, fate gives you like the ingredients. What you do with those ingredients is up to you. So, many of you have heard me talk about this before. The simile of karma is like the ingredients you've got to bake a cake. Two ladies, one lady's got very terrible ingredients. They've got white flour, which has got little green lumps of mould in it. And they've got white sugar, which somebody this morning sort of put their coffee spoons in, so there's all the brown lumps in that you have to take out. And then they've got this butter full of cholesterol. And they've got, what else have they got? They've got this fruit, like these raisins and sultanas, which are rock hard. And they've got this really old kitchen to try and cook it all in. A person with bad ingredients. The second lady has got these amazing ingredients. They've got this organically grown whole wheat flour with no pesticide within 100 miles. And they've got canola oil, which is supposed to be, you know, free from cholesterol. And they've got some beautiful honey from West Australia. But they've also got sort of fruit from Victoria. And they've got a marvellous new kitchen to cook it all in. They've got amazing ingredients. Who bakes the best cake? It's not always the person with the best ingredients, is it? Sometimes a woman with a very meagre ingredients, because she puts so much care, love and energy into what she's doing, sometimes she bakes a more delicious cake. She's got bad karma from the past, but she makes a lot of good karma in this life. And she makes the best cake of all. While someone's got lovely karma from the past, they waste it all. You know, I'm sure you've seen that. People are born to rich families, and they're really intelligent, they're really beautiful, they're talented, whatever they do, and they waste their life. They've had all these wonderful ingredients, but they haven't used them. And they're sort of stuffed up, as they say. As another person, they've born sort of like poor parents, sometimes only one parent or no parents, poor, not all that intelligent, but they become just wonderful, kind, beautiful people, even enlightened. So this is their karma. It gives you the ingredients, but what you do with it is most important. That's why in the time of the Buddha you get people from all walks of life becoming enlightened. What they did with their ingredients, which was important.
Can I just refer back to the question on the illiterate person who you said develops or goes into the state quicker than
yeah.
an intellectual person? And the night before you also mentioned that women tend to do the same thing.
So women are illiterate. I didn't mean that. Oh dear. Can I pass on that one? No.
I figured the logic sort of was right.
No, it's just there's two different types of people. You can understand where I'm coming from with the intellectual, the rational, you know, what I would have called right brain people if I didn't know that story about the boy without a brain. It's a generalization. You can have some males who are very left brain, very sensitive and don't think so much. You can have some women who think a lot, the Margaret Thatchers of the world. And it doesn't really matter. I mean, that's just a generalization. But you can see that those who are more intuitive, more emotional, more artistic, if you like, more imaginative, more in tune with their emotional world, the poets of the world, the musicians, they're the ones who can actually get into jhanas much easier. But the intellectuals, the ones who think a lot, you know, really into words and descriptions rather than feelings, that they have a harder time getting into the jhanas because they're questioning too much. They're thinking, they're trying to name so much. but when they got out of the jhanas, they can make much more sense of them. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. It's also an issue, I suppose, if we transcend our gender.
Well, that's it. All the gender actually is mostly like the behaviour which is imposed upon you because of that gender.
You're seeing that more as a conditioning.
Absolutely, yeah. It's not inherent. Yeah. It's just the way that women are conditioned, you know, through school and through family, and the way that boys are. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a simple question. In relation, it brought up my mind when we were talking about ill will towards irritating people. I guess we've all got difficult people in our lives, and to me it's the dilemma of whether one should use the difficult person as a reflection on yourself and to learn from them, because they're better to learn from a difficult person than an easy person, or should we seek the counsel of wise people only to help us along the path?
You can learn from both types. That's why that we had this little running joke in Thailand, because we learned so much from very irritating mosquitoes. We actually used to call them Ajahn mosquito. And there were our teachers. And sometimes if there was a particular monk who was giving you a very hard time, you know, you'd even call him Ajahn, even if he wasn't sort of giving talks. But he would teach you a lot of patience. A lot of compassion. So it's a very wonderful, skillful means. If there's someone in your house or someone in your office who does give you a difficult time, you know, you can learn so much from them if you look upon them as your teacher. However, you've got to balance yourself and know your limitations. And sometimes you do need to just escape and have some freedom and peace from those irritating people, because there's only so much you can take. Unless you're fully enlightened.
So you shouldn't seek them out to make them stronger?
No, I wouldn't seek them out. I would seek out mosquitoes. That's right. If you can't avoid them, then sort of learn from them. Because there's enough irritating things in life. And there's enough irritating people in life, so you don't need to seek more out. Just even just this body is irritating enough. You know, even just being in a meditation retreat, there's enough irritations even here. And yeah, this is a good as you can get it. So you don't need to speak about. Okay, I think that's enough for tonight. So thanks again for those questions.